Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 7, Donkey Work. No longer working full-time in the hotel, I had had to forego my salary there, and obviously, as a trustee, I couldn't take anything from the Donkey Sanctuary, so I was hopeful that there would be some income to be drawn from the 12 caravans in a field we'd bought with the house, and from 3 flats above what was being converted into our offices. But within a month of starting to convert the stables, it became apparent yet again that we were just not going to have sufficient room for all the donkeys. One way out was to convert the previous cowshed into a barn. There was already a very poor wooden floor there, but the contractors came in and had a look at the flooring upstairs and advised me that it would have to be completely redone with stressed concrete to take the weight of some 30 donkeys. The farm is on sloping ground, hence the barn with 2 levels. A member of the charity commission happened to make a visit the day after the contractors came, and I took him out to see the barn. "Do you really need a new floor, Mrs. Svensson?" he asked, walking round some of the hay that was stored there. Then, to my horror, he gave a yell as both feet began to go through the rotting boards. "Perhaps it was essential after all," he agreed. My hopes of an income from the flats were to be dashed. Getting staff was extremely difficult, as the farm is well off the beaten track. Frequently very good people would apply for jobs, but only if we could supply accommodation, and so, one by one, the flats had to become staff flats, and of course, bang went the large summer letting fees. From the time that the first donkeys came in, I had always kept a proper record sheet for each animal. Many of the donkeys arrived nameless, and I got a great deal of pleasure from choosing a name that I thought would suit the animal. Tiny Titch and So Shy, and, of course, all the donkeys from Miss Philpin, had had to be identified in some way. Halters had seemed a good idea to start with, and we had ordered sufficient for our first 50 donkeys. With small discs, rather like those on dog collars, with the donkey's name and number engraved on. This worked efficiently for the old and sick donkeys, but 2 naughty little donkeys like Bill and Ben would get the greatest pleasure from dragging each other round by their head collars day after day. Soon, they started adding other donkeys to their game, and I would go out in the morning to find 2 or 3 standing happily in the field, with the torn remnants of halters round their necks, totally unidentifiable. Obviously, when the donkeys were few in number, this was all right, but as we grew in size, it became a problem to solve. The farmer's view that the easiest way was to put a tag through the donkey's ear, as in cattle, was unacceptable, as donkeys are extremely sensitive around their ears, despite their size, and generally hate them even being touched. Freeze branding was suggested, and we did try this on 4 of the earliest donkeys. The idea was that a number was branded on by an implement which was so far below freezing that the donkey felt no pain, but it changed the pigmentation of the skin so that the hair would grow out white. It may work on cattle, but it certainly doesn't on donkeys, nor was I happy at their expressions during the branding. Within 2 months, George, a chocolate colour, was the only donkey where a number could be seen. The white and the grey donkeys just healed up and grew more grey or white hair, so that was no use. Finally, while passing a field of cows, I saw each one had a plastic collar round its neck with a number on. A bit of snooping gave me the name of the firm that made the collars, and they sent 20 on trial. At last we'd found something that worked. To begin with, they came with the name and number of the donkey already printed. But now, because of our large demand, we use a special type of electrically heated marking pen which melts the plastic sufficiently for the black ink placed in later to be permanent. So we can identify all our inmates and then look up their records if need be. Naming all the donkeys taken in from Miss Philpin's sanctuary was awful. Faced with a group of over 80, it took us 3 days to do a full medical inspection of each one and to write up their records with all the details. Some names came quite easily. The tall grey donkey was Lofty, and the very prim-looking little donkey became Gertrude. Eventually, I did revert back to Fred, George, Neddy, and so on, as the third day drew to a close. One of our biggest problems with large numbers of donkeys arriving was parasites, so each received a worm dose. All donkeys have parasites to a greater or lesser degree, and these have to be controlled regularly. Otherwise, a large proportion of the food that we feed in at one end is taken by the parasites. The fencing had been done to give us individual 5-acre pastures so that each one could be rested at regular intervals to let the grass grow, but more important, to kill off the parasites passed on from the donkey droppings and prevent them from being recirculated. We had sufficient donkeys to need them grouped. There were the stallions awaiting castration and needing to be kept away from all the other donkeys. Mares with foals, which we named the nursery group, a group of new geldings which were extremely lively and spent most of the day playing with each other and galloping round the field. And then the geriatrics, which always arouse a deal of interest. We class a donkey as a geriatric when it reaches the age of 30. Aging them is difficult. It takes years of practice. But one key is similar to the horse, in that the teeth are the main indicator. With a donkey, the top teeth, instead of growing longer and longer as the age of the donkey increases, wear right back until sometimes we have a donkey with an enormously long lower set of teeth, with the top set right down to the gums. In addition, the hooves give an indication, as does the general conformation and condition of the body. We know that donkeys can live until they are 50 years old, and we have had donkeys who have reached this age and even past it. A problem with the geriatrics is always to decide when it is kinder to put them down than to keep them alive. I watch my donkeys in the geriatric ward for many, many hours, and I can only say that having spent a whole lifetime working for man, reaching sanctuary gives them their first taste of freedom. I have seen donkeys coming exhausted, broken in spirit, able only to stand quietly in the corner with their head drooping, and just pleased to be able to rest for a while. The same donkeys after 2 months in the sanctuary are almost unrecognizable, gradually realizing they aren't going to be mistreated or have to go out to work on the beaches again, and that the food comes often and regularly. But there are those cases where the cruelty and mistreatment have gone too far. Where we find an elderly donkey spending more of the day lying down than standing up, then a decision has to be taken. They get what can only be termed bed sores from lying down too much. Once these begin to ulcerate, we call the vets, and if we consider the donkey is suffering and has no future hope, then our poor old friend is humanely put down. It is always done here on our own premises, and before the event, the donkeys are always given ginger nuts, which they absolutely adore, and we are always with them when their final moments come. We decided to evolve a donkey charter. This grants to every donkey admitted to the sanctuary the right to life regardless of age or health, and the best possible treatment, care and drugs to preserve its life to the maximum. It grants permanent peace and freedom, the care and protection of the sanctuary, and the right to return if rehabilitated to a new home. When the time comes, it grants a dignified, peaceful death, this only being induced in the event of extreme suffering as agreed by both the veterinary advisors and sanctuary staff. We also set up an intensive care unit. This, as its name implies, is where the donkeys are under constant medical, veterinary and farrier's care every single day, and it is an area split into small units, each one supplied with its own infrared lamp. Two are specifically fitted out with slings, so that in the event of a donkey being temporarily unable to stand unaided, we can support it during the time of its treatment to prevent it getting ulcerated sores. Donkeys such as Jem and Hansel and Gretel would be permanent members of such a unit. Each unit of donkeys was given two areas adjoining each other in which to roam and graze. By careful planning, John and I arranged it so that two groups of donkeys could never talk to each other over the hedge. This was to avoid the danger of infection from one group to another and to prevent diseases developing between the animals. This was to prove absolutely invaluable when equine flu hit the sanctuary. Until that time, we had always assumed that a 3-week isolation period would be long enough, but how wrong we were. The group of 12 donkeys fed on cake did their 3 weeks in isolation and were then moved out into the nursery unit, as many of the mares were in foal. Bilko and my poppet went into the intensive care unit. 3 days later, I noticed that one of the donkeys, called Fuzzy, had developed a very bad mucus discharge from her nose. Her breathing was very rapid, and I didn't like her general appearance at all. She was standing very quietly and had sweated up slightly. I called the vets, who put her back into the isolation unit straight away. By next morning, however, two more of the donkeys from the group of 12 were in trouble, including my poppet. Immediate treatment by antibiotic was essential, and we started the first injection of Pembrotin that day. The next day came confirmation of the ghastly news. It was a real disaster. Amongst all my old and sick donkeys, there were many who were totally incapable of surviving such an attack, and speed in sorting out those donkeys who could be infected was essential. Everybody rallied round, Niels, the children and Julie from the office. Fortunately, none of the animals had been allowed into the fields, but all the intensive care units were isolated, as was the whole of the nursery group. In this little group was a donkey that we all loved particularly. Dawlish Infant School had been to visit the sanctuary on the day that one of the rescued donkeys from Miss Philpin's sanctuary, Chippy, had produced a little foal. To make things more interesting and to get the children involved with the sanctuary, we had suggested that they should name the foal, and the school rang me a week later to say that they had asked every child to put a name on a piece of paper and put it into a ballot box. They had then chosen the name which was most popular. To everybody's amazement, this turned out to be John. We already had one John, and so he became Johnny Dawlish. To our horror, Johnny was one of the first little foals to be affected, and he died. The very day after, the school was due to visit, and this left the sanctuary with a tremendous problem. We did have other little foals, so would it be kinder to the children to hide the truth? We discussed it with the school and decided that it was probably better that they accepted that Johnny Dawlish had died. The coach arrived and the children got out very quietly. Their teaching staff had already told them what had happened, and we held a little remembrance service for Johnny. I was heartbroken. I was already upset at losing Johnny, and the sight of all those little faces was almost more than I could bear. The children decided to adopt Chippy, his mother, in Johnny's place. We fought the flu for a further 3 weeks, an immense workload as each donkey had to be examined each day for the first sign of infection. My stethoscope proved invaluable. The first sign was an increased respiration rate, and this enabled us to save the lives of many of our donkeys. That no two groups of donkeys met proved the saving of the situation. We lost two donkeys, including Johnny Dawlish and my darling Peanuts, but everybody else recovered. Thereafter, we decided that, despite the cost, which was approximately £5 per donkey, we would inoculate every newcomer against equine flu, and that the isolation period should be extended to 4 weeks. The anti-flu injection also included an anti-tetanus dose, and this we also welcomed, as there was always fear of tetanus where such a large number of donkeys were gathered together. The donkey's day starts with the clattering of buckets in the feed house at 8 a.m. All the donkeys receive a breakfast equivalent of a cupped handful of low-protein pony nuts. Unlike ponies, donkeys do not need much protein, and an excess can actually poison them. After breakfast, the donkeys have unlimited amounts of sweet hay, and those fit and out in the field units spend the rest of the day happily grazing in the fields. Then I do the donkey rounds of all those in intensive care, and they are thoroughly checked to make sure no new symptoms have developed. Those needing injections are rewarded with a ginger biscuit if they stand quietly. The farrier comes at frequent intervals, as many of those in intensive care have the most appalling hoof problems. Particularly bad cases are the donkeys left in orchards untended since ponies have taken their place, and those coming in after doing the rounds of the markets. Some are so severe as to need almost daily pairing. Our farrier, John Craddock, is an extremely kind and skilled man, and he takes infinite care over even the very old ones' feet. After their treatment, they are allowed out to graze for the day in the home paddock, which runs down from the intensive care block. Any sign of rain and back they come. Those very sick, of course, have to stay inside under the warmth of the infrared lamp. Cold nights mean woolen rugs for many of the sick ones, as this enables them to use their restricted energy on getting themselves fit rather than in keeping themselves warm. The evening meal is always a great delight to the donkeys. It consists of bran, flaked maize, crushed oats, molasses, a form of black treacle, dampened down with a liquid made up of cow's milk, warm water, and cytochron syrup, which has a vitamin and calcium additive. Where there are more than two donkeys in a box, separate feeding troughs are given to make sure that each donkey gets the right amount. The sight of the old and sick donkeys enjoying their food and happy makes me realise it's all worthwhile. As with humans, illness doesn't just strike during the day, and I never cease to be amazed at the donkey's intelligence in calling for help at night. Naughty Face, who had joined the sanctuary group, was always kept within range of my window, and she sensed immediately if anyone was in trouble anywhere on the sanctuary. I strongly believe that donkeys convey messages to each other. Certainly, when Naughty Face set off in the middle of the night, we would always find something wrong, even if it was in the farthest field away from the sanctuary. She was an extremely intelligent donkey who, when she saw trouble, never stopped braying until the lights came on in our bedroom, which she could see from her stable. There were innumerable instances of this warning behaviour, the most usual being a donkey who had collapsed in the stable and was struggling desperately to get back up on its feet. One particular night, there was a tremendous storm blowing when Naughty Face began her bray. Niels insisted on coming with me, for which I was extremely grateful. We looked into every intensive care box, and nobody was in trouble. The only donkeys still braying were in the field that stretched almost down to the sea. With our big storm torch, we trudged down across the field, and there, with all the donkeys in a little circle around her, watching with great interest, stood Beth, one of the mares that had come from Miss Philpin, and on the ground beside her was a tiny foal. Niels picked the little foal up in his arms and carried it back to the intensive care unit. Beth followed us there. We named the foal Storm for obvious reasons, and standing looking at Beth enjoying the hot mash I had made for her, and the little foal suckling for the first time, more than made up for our disturbed night. Jem had recovered sufficiently to go out into the field every day and was obviously enjoying her life very much at Slade House Farm. However, she seemed to be slowing down, and one day, as David was bringing them back into the intensive care unit for their feed, Jem lay down in the yard. She wouldn't get up, and I was surprised to see David lying down on the ground next to Jem. "I thought she might get up when I got up," said David, "if I lay down like this." "What a good idea," I said, "because we all hate the ignominy of pushing and pulling donkeys." I lay down on the other side of Jem, and after a few moments, both David and I slowly stood up together. To our joy, Jem stood up with us and very slowly walked into her box. But that night, Jem, instead of attacking the hayrack with her usual gusto, was standing quietly in the corner with her eyes half shut. I talked to her gently for a few moments, but she didn't respond, and I went to bed feeling slightly worried. The following morning, David gave me the very sad news that Jem had passed away quietly in the night. For once, none of the donkeys had told me. I think they all realized that her time had come, and that she died a peaceful, dignified death. Which of us could ask for more? Several of the new arrivals at this time had been rescued from markets by members of the public, as they were convinced that donkeys were on their way to be slaughtered for salami or pet food. The sanctuary never purchases a donkey, as this could create a market similar to that made by Miss Philpin. Amongst Miss Philpin's papers, I found a letter from a salami-making company, which confirmed worries that many of the donkeys were in fact condemned to this fate when bought by dealers in markets. What was retrieved from Miss Philpin's files went as follows. Mr. Philpin, The Donkey Sanctuary, Springfield, Foster's Lane, Woodley, Barks, 7th of October, 1972. Dear Mr. Philpin, I am prompted by your advertisement in today's Guardian to write to you with what I hope will be a mutually beneficial business proposition. I am the British representative of an Italian-owned company who are experiencing supply difficulties in obtaining a continuing supply of donkeys, one of the principal ingredients of salami. My company has authorized me to offer to purchase all the donkeys currently in your care and all you manage to acquire in the future. We are particularly interested in British animals, as the standard of care during their lives tends to render their flesh most suitable for the salami-producing process. You would be in a most fortunate position to make a profit because one of our lorries would call at monthly intervals, thus relieving you of all the expenses associated with transportation, etc. At the same time, you would have our assurance that these animals would be reasonably, humanely destroyed on arrival in Italy, whilst helping to alleviate the food production problems already emerging in Europe. May I look forward to hearing from you in the very near future? Yours faithfully. At this time, purely by accident, one of the visitors in the hotel who came from Essex had been involved in the donkey meat trade, and I gleaned a great deal of information from him, which proved conclusively to me that this exporting of donkeys was going on. They were quite good for meat, as there was 2.5% bone-to-weight ratio. The average weight exported stood at £350 per donkey. They had found that the weight loss on young or middle-aged donkeys per journey was approximately £30. An old donkey travelling had a weight loss as low as £2.5. The donkeys were sent via an East Anglian shipper. At the slaughterhouse, the head, neck and lower legs were discarded as waste. At that time, transport costs to Italy, the main importers, were too high, and Germany was taking a limited supply. The price was 10p per pound, less 2.5% bone of the neck carcass weight. These factual details had horrified me, despite contrary information from ministry records. I have to accept the fact that animals are brought up in captivity and slaughtered to provide food for humans, And this is what every farmer is in effect doing. But in accepting it, I hope that the animals are reared in the best possible conditions and slaughtered the most humane way possible to prevent suffering. Following these lines, I would accept that there could be a case for using donkeys for salami, but to take half-starved, ill-treated and terrified donkeys and to put them through the ordeal of shipment abroad to face slaughter seems cruel to me. Amelia was exactly the colour of a child's rocking horse, a beautiful dappled grey. She had the most terrible feet you can imagine when she arrived, and was unable to stand firmly on any of her hooves. They were bent and twisted out of recognition, and as she stood she would rock gently backwards and forwards. John Craddock, our farrier, spent hours with her, and eventually we did get her so that she could move around without discomfort. She spent hours nuzzling Suey, who had come in from a beach in the north of England. Some beach operators are extremely good and concerned over their animals, but this had not been Suey's fortune. She had collapsed on the beach. A bystander telephoned us about this unconscious donkey lying there and mentioned a vet had been called, and considered the donkey had had a heart attack. It was a long way away, but we arranged with the owner to pick the donkey up and David went off in the new wagon, which we had purchased specially for the job. It had padded sides, so if need be, we could transport a donkey standing up, supported by special slings. It was a tiring journey for Suey. She arrived back, carefully supported, but with her eyes tight shut. "She hasn't moved since I set off. She's had a little water, but just keeps her eyes shut all the time and obviously takes no interest at all in her surroundings," said David. Her eyes were still tight shut as I stroked her gently on the nose. "It's all right, Suey. You've arrived," I said. "There's no need to worry any more. Come on now, old lady. Let's get you off the box." We undid the slings and she stood shakily without attempting to move. Whenever the box arrived in the yard, all the donkeys used to put their heads out through the door to see who had come, and they were becoming impatient. A great bray came from almost every stable. Slowly, Suey's eyes opened, and I found myself looking into the saddest pair of eyes I had ever seen. "Come on, Suey," I urged. "It's all right. You're not going to have to work any more. Your only job now is to get yourself fit and well." She seemed to give herself a little shake, and then slowly she began to walk forward, down the ramp of the box. She stood looking at the row of faces peering at her, her ears, which had been pressed almost flat against her mane, slowly began to turn upright. We led her into her box, which must have been heaven for Suey. She looked around, and then, to our joy, walked across to the hay and, having given it a few nudges with her nose, began to munch. Our vet could find nothing wrong, and neither could we. From the moment she arrived, Suey became a fit donkey. My theory is she had just had enough work and decided she was going to lie down until things either got better or worse. And people say donkeys have no intelligence.